on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And yes, another week in lockdown. And I hope you're all still staying fit and safe and well. And obviously taking as much care of yourselves as you can in every aspect, not just to fight off the virus. Yes, we're going to be talking about how you can keep yourself healthy and virus related subjects, obviously, yet again, because it's still very much in the news. But I'll also be talking about some other things as well. I'm going to start with our usual news roundup, and we'll begin with that now. Now, yes, this is virus related, I guess, in a way, but zinc, there's a lot of talk about zinc at the moment being helpful in warding off colds. But apparently sucking a zinc lozenge won't make your cold go away any sooner. But that could be because most popular brands contain very little zinc. A lozenge typically contains more than 13 milligrams of zinc, and that's too little to have any effect on the common cold. And people who suck lozenges every day still suffer from a cold for around 5 days, along with the rest of us. And researchers from the University of Helsinki in Finland tested the effectiveness of zinc lozenges on a group of 88 volunteers who had a cold, and half were asked to suck 6 lozenges a day for 5 days, and the rest were instead given a placebo lozenge with no active ingredient. But there was no difference in the duration of the cold between the groups, although surprisingly those given a placebo recovered quicker afterwards. And the results don't mean zinc lozenges are useless against the common cold. Instead, it suggests that manufacturers should make lozenges with a higher zinc content that dissolve more slowly on the tongue. So there we are. So check your zinc lozenges have actually got enough zinc in them to make it worthwhile taking them. And walking 10,000 steps a day has become a gold standard for achieving a healthy life, but it's more than an urban myth, and it certainly doesn't help you lose weight. In fact, people who are walking up to 15,000 steps a day are still putting on the pounds, a new study has discovered. Having said that, the study group were all students enrolled in their first year at university, and freshmen typically gain up to 9 pounds as home-cooked food is replaced by takeaways. And the walkers at least put on less weight than that. They gained 3.5 pounds over the 6-month study, but some weight gain was seen across all the groups, whether they were walking 10,000, 12,500 or 15,000 steps 6 days a week. It's the conclusion of many studies: you can't outrun or walk a bad diet. The latest research was carried out by a team from Brigham Young University, who monitored 120 freshmen to see if walking could help them keep off the pounds. Exercise alone is not always the most effective way to lose weight, and if you track steps, it might have a benefit in increasing physical activity, but our study showed it won't translate into maintaining weight or preventing weight gain, according to the researchers. Although walking didn't help the students lose weight, the extra activity could have a positive effect on the students' emotional well-being and overall health, and it has to be better than sitting in front of a screen all day, the researchers said. Well, that's it. I agree with that, definitely. And supplementing with niacinamide, which is vitamin B3, could reduce arthritis pain and stiffness, which is very interesting, isn't it? And if you're not sleeping well, I'm going to be talking about a little bit more about sleep as well later on in the show. It could be down to your diet, and especially the refined carbs and sugars you're eating. People who eat white stuff, which is processed snacks, white bread and soda, for instance, will find it harder to sleep at night because of the bodily processes their diet is triggering. And in particular, the body releases insulin to break down the sugars in refined carbs, and the sudden drop in glucose leads to an increase in the hormones adrenaline and cortisol. And this in turn causes sleepless nights, researchers from Columbia University in Irving Medical Center have found. By comparison, people eating more vegetables and fruits were less likely to have a bad night's sleep. Although these foods also contain sugar, their fiber content reduces spikes in blood sugar, with a third of adults regularly experiencing insomnia. New ways of improving sleep patterns need to be explored, especially as sleeping pills come with side effects, the researchers say. And eating more vegetables and less meat and dairy could lower your risk of heart disease and help you live longer. It's all to do with a special class of amino acids that contain the element sulfur. These are primarily found in protein-rich foods such as meat, dairy, nuts, and soy products. A diet low in these amino acids increases longevity and health, at least according to animal studies. And the average American eats nearly three times the amount of sulfur amino acids that the body actually needs. Researchers from Penn State College of Medicine wanted to determine the impact of the amino acids on health and track the diets and biomarkers of more than 11,000 healthy people. The average consumption of sulfur amino acids was 2.5 times higher than the recommended daily allowance of just 15 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, and those eating the most also had the highest levels of biomarkers for heart disease. Conversely, those who ate less of the amino acids had fewer biological markers for heart disease and other chronic conditions. And foods that are low in the acids include grains, vegetables, and fruits. Now, yoga is the best exercise for chronic back pain or low back pain, but when the pain is acute, Tai Chi apparently is a better option. Both have their benefits, and a third alternative exercise, Qigong, does as well. But there just aren't enough studies that prove it, say researchers in a review of the evidence so far. With around 80% of adults suffering from low back pain at some point, it's important to discover positive ways to counter it. Researchers from Florida Atlantic University took another look at 32 studies that have researched the benefits of yoga, Tai Chi, which uses gentle exercises and stretching, and Qigong, where slow and fluid movements are employed. All three exercises helped with the low back pain itself. They reduced the pain intensity, improved function, and lessened the degree of disability caused by the pain. And they also helped with psychological problems related to back pain, including depression and anxiety. Overall, regular yoga exercise was the best for reducing pain, but Tai Chi was better for easing acute pain, especially among men in their 20s. There were only 3 studies into Qigong, and although these findings did show the exercise helped, more evidence is needed, the researchers felt. But all 3 could be promising, effective treatments and alternatives to pain medication, surgery and nerve blockers, the standard responses from conventional medicine. That's according to the researchers, so that's all very positive news. And we've known for a long time, I think, that yoga is a very positive benefit, or has a very positive benefit to many, many health conditions. So I think we tend to become a little bit of afraid of moving, afraid of exercising, don't we, when we have something wrong with us. But I think doctors are now advising us to keep on the move a little bit more and to stretch and move. And when you stretch and move, you're kind of clearing blockages that may have happened in your body, and, you know, blood flow, flow of fluids through your body, and digestive system, etc., easing the joints. Yeah, exercise is very good for all of those conditions. And some news on the HPV vaccines to protect against cervical cancer. There's a possibility that they aren't being as effective as first thought. The 2 vaccines, Gardasil and Cervarix, are taking credit for stopping cervical abnormalities that never would have developed into cancer. These benign abnormalities, called low-grade cervical changes, can resolve themselves spontaneously without progressing to anything more serious, whether or not a person has the HPV vaccine. Studies investigating the effectiveness of the vaccine should have focused solely on high-grade cervical disease that often becomes cancerous, but only after 10 years, say researchers from Newcastle and Queen Mary universities. The researchers looked at 12 studies that had assessed the effectiveness of the 2 vaccines. Not only had the studies included low-grade cervical changes, they'd also tested cervical samples every 6 to 12 months, instead of the more usual 36 months, and so were picking up many more cases of benign abnormalities. They found insufficient data to clearly conclude that HPV vaccine prevents the higher grade abnormal cell changes, say the researchers. In other words, there was no evidence the vaccines were working. Instead, the researchers recommend that women should have regular screening as a more effective way to protect against cervical cancer. And further proof that the vaccine may not be working came with the news that cervical cancer rates have been rising dramatically among women in their late 20s. There's been a 50 54% increase in cases in the UK in the past decade, which researchers from Cancer Research UK say is due to a drop in the rate of smear tests. Since 2010, screening rates have fallen by around 8%, and the HPV vaccines were introduced in 2008. So, that obviously needs a little bit more research, doesn't it? So that's our little news roundup for today. And some of those little interesting pieces, little interesting snippets. Right, we're going to have a little break now. And after the break, I shall be talking to you about sleep. Stay tuned for more. Don't drop off in between.
One, two, three, four! My bed and a pillow for my head. I got a pencil full of lead and some water for my throat. I got buttons for my coat and sails on my boat. So much more than I needed before. I got money in the meter and a turbo heater. Oh, and now it's getting on the road. It's only getting sweeter. I got legs on my chairs and a head full of hair. Bought a pan and some shoes in my feet. I got a shelf full of books and most of my teeth. Two pairs of socks and a door with a lock. I got food in my belly and a license for my telly. And nothing's gonna bring me down. Guitar and ties in my car. I got most of the memes and scripts for the scenes. I'm out and about, so I'm in with a shout. I got a favorite chat, but better than that. Food in my belly and a license for my daddy. And nothing's gonna bring me down. I'm about to blow it out of hand. Nothing's gonna bring me down. Boys, the best of all, I've got my baby. I've got my baby. She's my divine, and says she's all mine. And nothing's gonna bring me down. No. Oh, best of all, I've got my baby. Oh, best of all, I've got my baby. Nothing's gonna bring me down. Oh, she's mighty fine, and she's all mine. And nothing's gonna bring me down. She's mighty fine, and she's all mine. And nothing's gonna bring me down. What is it? No.
Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Yes, it's time to talk about the virus again, but this time connected with sleep. Are you getting enough sleep? At this time, all the heightened stress that most of us are experiencing, our internal body clocks and the ability to sleep may be disrupted just when we most need them to stay healthy. New research has shown that our response to infection changes over the course of each day, and even more importantly, that sleep disruption can leave our immune system compromised. Now, before any of us were paying much attention to COVID-19, in January, the National Institutes of Health in the US sponsored a major international meeting on this topic, highlighting the potential clinical use of sleep in regulating our immunity. The immune system is the body's defence against infections, providing us with multiple layers of protection. The first barrier is the skin, which is composed of tightly packed cells that normally prevent viruses or bacteria entering the body. The skin's topmost layer consists of dead cells that form a dense physical barrier to resist any invasion. And in addition, on the skin's surface are secretions called antimicrobial peptides that can inhibit the growth and even kill some bugs that could otherwise cause disease. But bacteria and viruses can remain alive on the skin and can be transferred to less well-protected areas, such as the eyes, nose and lungs, where they gain entry. Normally, antiseptic tears kill bugs getting into the eyes, and the mucous membranes that line the nose and lungs produce mucus that traps invaders. Now, in the lungs, tiny hair-like structures move the mucus and bug cocktail up to the upper airway, where it's then swallowed and destroyed by stomach acids. Alternatively, the mucus can be coughed up or sneezed out with the trapped bugs. However, if pathogens do succeed in entering the body, then the second layer of defence in the bloodstream works to recognise and kill invaders. A key group of white blood cells called B lymphocytes is triggered to make antibodies which lock onto specific parts of the bug. And then another group of white blood cells called T cells, which are called into action through chemical signals, destroy the bugs. After they've been activated, some B lymphocytes become memory B cells and can stay in the body for years. They remember how to fight a particular bug and can make antibodies very quickly should the immune system see that pathogen again. Now, this is how vaccines work. A non-infectious protein from the bug is injected into the body, triggering the B lymphocytes to make antibodies and memory B cells then protect us from another attack. Meanwhile, other groups of white blood cells can activate inflammation to attack the bug. They detect the invasion and trigger plasma, the clear fluid part of blood, to move from blood vessels into the site of invasion. This fluid contains antibodies and other agents that will attack invading bugs. Some of this fluid is also swept into the lymph nodes, where bacteria and viruses are destroyed by white blood cells. The plasma is effectively cleaned in the lymph nodes and returned to the blood. So what's the link between the immune system and the body clock? Every tissue and organ in your body operates according to biological rhythms. The so-called 24-hour body clock or circadian rhythm instructs us when it's the best time to sleep, eat, think, and undertake a myriad of essential biological tasks. This daily adjustment allows us to perform at our best in a dynamic world, fine-tuning our biology to the varied demands imposed by the 24-hour day and night cycle. And without this precise regulation by our circadian rhythms, we would be in a mess. And we know that the body clock has a big influence over our immune responses, starting with the skin. The skin becomes more leaky in the evening, meaning that there's more water loss then, which is part of the reason we experience increased itchiness at night. The increased permeability of skin combined with scratching, which breaks down the skin barrier, increases the chance of pathogens entering the body. Interestingly, blood flow to the skin increases at night, giving immune cells a better chance of attacking invaders as soon as they get in. These are not the only changes seen in the skin across the day. If you cut or burn yourself, the damaged skin will heal more than twice as fast as if the injury was done during the day compared to at night. So you heal more in the day than at night. This all makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. It's more likely that we will damage our skin or encounter an invading virus by day when we're moving around our environment compared to the middle of the night. We also tend to shed our skin cells during the early part of the night, which means that bugs trapped on the skin are removed. Although the chances of being infected through the skin are higher at night, the skin is an effective barrier that infection, particularly by viruses, is usually through another route. And the lungs provide the easiest way in. The cells of the immune system are there too, waiting to defend us, but they also show a circadian rhythm in their ability to help us. A Cambridge University study published in 2016 exposed mice to the herpes virus at different times of the day. And if the virus was given at the start of their sleep, the virus multiplied 10 times faster than 10 hours later when the mice were active. A study on humans published in 2016 by researchers at the University of Birmingham showed similar time of day differences. Elderly people were vaccinated against a type of flu virus either in the morning or in the afternoon. And those vaccinated in the morning showed a 3 times higher antibody response than those who were vaccinated in the afternoon, leaving the latter group less well protected. This may have implications for the timing of giving any future vaccine that is developed for COVID-19. The lungs, after all, are the main route of infection for the virus. And the bottom line is that studies repeatedly show that our immune system is turned up during the daytime when we're active and more likely to encounter bugs from other people. At night, though, we're not as good at resisting infection. This raises important issues, not just for a vaccine longer term, but more immediately for our key workers and when they're exposed to infection. As they are more vulnerable at night, perhaps protective clothing is even more important during the night shift. So why is the immune system not working for and its best for us all the time? A balance must be achieved between defence against bacteria and viruses and damage to us from our own immune response. An overactive immune system can lead to autoimmune disorders where the body cannot tell the difference between its normal cells and invaders. A regular sleep-wake cycle and body clock can help maintain this balance, changing the aggressiveness of the immune system to a time when it's most likely to be useful. This helps reduce the chances of overactivity of the immune system and damage to our cells. It's well established that sleep and circadian rhythm disruption in shift workers or other groups experiencing shortened sleep is linked to poor mental and physical health, and this is also true for the immune system. Research involving mice has found the immune response was much less aggressive during sleep, and crucially, in mice with disrupted body clocks, the immune response was poor whatever time the mice encountered the virus, and similar findings have been repeated in humans. A study from the University of Chicago in 2002 studied two groups of people who were immunized against the flu virus while keeping two different sleep schedules. The group who were allowed to sleep just 4 hours per night when given the jab had less than half the level of protective antibodies to the flu virus than the group who slept their usual 7.5 to 8.5 hours per night after the jab. And similarly, in 2012, researchers from the University of Pittsburgh studied the antibody response to hepatitis, or to the hepatitis A vaccination. People who had less than 6 hours sleep per night were at a significant risk of being unprotected from vaccination compared with those who slept more than 7 hours. So why does shortened and disrupted sleep reduce our ability to resist infection? Part of the answer seems to be that people experiencing sleep deprivation and circadian rhythm disruption release more of the stress hormones cortisol and adrenaline. And stress is a bit like the first gear of a car engine. It provides rapid acceleration, which can be very useful short term, but if you keep the engine in first gear continuously, then it will break down. Now, the stress response prepares us to fight or flee, getting the body ready for vigorous action. And this involves diverting its energies from functions such as immunity. And one of the consequences of sleep deprivation is a suppressed immune system, and the results can be devastating. So not only does sleep disruption increase our chances of infection, but it can also lead to the reawakening of dormant viruses lurking in the body, such as herpes, and increases our chance of chronic inflammation. In turn, constant inflammation has been linked to lasting damage to the heart, brain, and other vital organs, leading to poor overall health and a lowered immune response. So, what does that mean, basically? So, our first line of defence is the skin, and so a final shower or vigorous face and hand wash to remove bugs from the skin before we sleep is probably sensible to remove any lurking bacteria or viruses and prevent them getting into the body. And as there is evidence that vaccination is the most effective during the first part of the day, when we eventually have a vaccine against COVID-19, we may want to schedule vaccination, particularly in the elderly and those who show weakened immunity in the morning. And we are more vulnerable to infection at night, so the use of protective clothing by frontline night staff is even more important. So some interesting facts about sleep there. I'm going to continue talking to sleep. Or talking to sleep. No, I'm getting myself in a muddle now. Oh. No, we're going to take a little break now. And after the break, I will be back talking to you again about sleep. That's what I meant to say. Lots more right after this. Stop, oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman.
Postman, look and see if there's a letter for me.
community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Now, if you've been having unusually vivid dreams during lockdown, you're not alone. I know there's a lot on social media at the moment about people having intense, weird and very vivid dreams. Now, according to Harvard Medical School sleep experts, people are having more dreams, longer dreams, more vivid dreams and more bizarre dreams. And the one professor has been doing a study on this, and he's received 2,500 responses to a survey into dreams during the pandemic. And some respondents are dreaming they have the virus themselves or that their parents or children are ill with it. Now, other images, such as being chased by swarms of insects or being in danger of being engulfed by a tidal wave, are likely metaphors for the disease. So it's easy to assume such dreams are the result of the anxiety we're feeling by day spilling over into our nights, and possibly the two are linked. Everybody is being exposed to fear and anxiety about the virus, and this anxiety can feed our dreams. But stress may not be simply affecting the content of our dreams. Tossing and turning due to pandemic-related worries may also make it easier for us to recall them. You have to wake up during a dream in the 2 minutes of the dream finishing to remember it. And the more you wake up, the more dreams you'll remember. So as well, lockdown lions could also be fueling our nightmares. Sleep is made up of various cycles, and most of our dreams occur during rapid eye movement sleep. And these REM cycles lengthen as the night goes on. So those who are now not commuting and can sleep longer will have more opportunity to dream. So that's interesting, isn't it? Have you been having any weird and wonderful and strange dreams? I mean, I've had quite a few, but then I always dream a lot, so it's nothing new for me. I tend to have quite vivid and even lucid dreams as well, and it's a whole fascinating subject. So there is definitely some connection between your dreams and what's happening in your life and your fears and worries and everything like that. So they are often quite interesting to delve into. But it's never been more important to get good quality sleep, as disrupted sleep reduces the effectiveness of our immune system. The good news is that 62% of us are getting just as much sleep, if not more, than before the lockdown began, according to a recent study from King's College in London. But that still leaves 38% of people experiencing disturbed sleep. So there are a few ways that you can get a little better quality sleep. Now, sit by a window first thing in the morning. Our bodies need bright natural light to sync it with the natural light and dark cycle, leading to better sleep and robust immunity. And with self-isolation, many of us will not be getting enough natural light to achieve this, as the levels of artificial light we experience in the home are not bright enough to register with the special receptors in the eye that play a key role in this process. If you're unable to spend any time outside, get as close to the window as possible, especially in the early morning, for at least 30 minutes. And think about taking vitamin D. If you're not getting much natural light, your body also won't be able to synthesize vitamin D, which is made by the skin in response to natural light. Vitamin D is needed to keep bones, teeth, and muscles healthy, and there is also some evidence to suggest that a deficiency is associated with a higher risk of sleep disorders. Ultraviolet light, or UV light, specifically UVB from sunlight, helps us make vitamin D in our skin, but window glass blocks most UVB light, so sitting by the window won't help with vitamin D production. If you can't get outside, consider taking vitamin D supplements. And exercise outside daily. The exercise itself and the exposure to bright light will both aid relaxation and help regulate the body clock. Don't stay up all night watching box sets. It's so tempting, isn't it? Maintain a daily routine, getting up and going to bed at the same reasonable time. And this has been shown overwhelmingly to help you get good sleep. And good sleep not only helps your immune response, it also improves problem solving, mood, empathy, and your sense of humour. And watch your alcohol intake too. There have been reports that although about 6% of people have stopped drinking alcohol, 21% have been drinking more since the lockdown began. Now, too much alcohol can badly disrupt sleep and reduce immunity, and it has been linked with reduced activity of immune cells in the lungs and reduces the number and function of B lymphocytes and T cells that help us fight off infection. Call your parents or other relatives who are on their own. The sudden loss of regular social contact, particularly in older people, can increase stress. If you have elderly family, friends or neighbours, call them regularly and ask them gently what time they went to bed, what time they ate and if they've spent time outside and that they're sitting by a window. These conversations will help reduce feelings of isolation, worry and stress and at the same time remind the individual to maintain a daily structure. And don't follow the news in bed. Even during normal times, smartphones by the bed can be a problem for sleep. Leave your mobile in another room and use sleep as a time to isolate yourself from the latest sadness of the pandemic. Separate work and free time. And with so many of us working at home, it's critical to ensure that we take time to relax. And for many, the vacuum created by all those cancelled meetings or trips has sucked in endless virtual meetings, and we're stuck looking at a screen all day, even more than normal. So make sure you get the balance right between virtual meetings, actual work and time doing what you enjoy. Listening to music, reading or whatever, all this will help you to sleep better. And it really is vital to get as much sleep as we can. I mean, and maybe you're not sleeping, you know, your full 8 hours. Maybe you're relaxing a little bit more in the day. And also if you're having naps in the day or things like that, that will also affect your ability to sleep in the evening. So make sure you're not sleeping too much during the day so you don't get a good quality sleep in the evening. You know, that can also kind of backfire on you, can't it? So It's very difficult, isn't it, to get that balance and to strike that balance the whole time. So making sure you get good quality sleep at night is really, really important. And when you're hit with a morning jaw pain as well, is really, really awful, isn't it? Bruxism is the clenching and grinding of your teeth, and that could be to blame for your pain. And considering it's the third most common sleeping disorder behind insomnia and sleep apnea, the root of bruxism is twofold. If your top and bottom jaw don't seamlessly fit together, you could be subconsciously shifting your jaw throughout the night in an attempt to get comfortable. Or you may have what's known as a parafunctional habit. Similarly to biting your nails, clenching or grinding can be a physical tick that serves little purpose, but it's soothing in a psychological or neurological sense. Either way, bruxism pain is primarily caused by muscle fatigue. Now, your jaw should be resting at night, but with bruxism, it's like your jaw is exercising for 8 hours straight. Just like you would become sore after an excessive workout, so does your jaw. And the muscles develop a chronic strain that feels stiff, sore and painful to move. But the good news is that parafunctional habits can be broken, but it's easier said than done. The key to reducing pain from bruxism is allowing the jaw to relax in a stable position. So maybe changing sleep positions would do the trick, which just so happens to be one of the most frequent questions that patients ask, apparently. But the answer is is neither one nor the other. Some very early studies indicate that sleeping on your back or side could decrease clenching and grinding, but it's not really a useful recommendation. Patients cannot comfortably control their sleeping position, and anecdotally, many patients with bruxism report that they already sleep on their side or back. Now, if you're hung up on the idea that resting on your side allows for your pillow to support more of your jaw's weight, it can help a little, and it does help restrict movement. But the real solution is reducing and managing your psychological stress. That's the best thing that you can do for your jaw and for your life as well. Mental stress increases the muscular tension that fuels bruxism. And you could stretch your jaw by opening your mouth wide periodically throughout the day and holding for 15 seconds at a time. Now, if you're experiencing sort of headaches, fatigue, ear pain consistently for more than 2 weeks, you maybe need to consult a professional for extra help. And a professional should be able to easily improve any disharmony in your jaw alignment, recommend a mouth guard, replace worn down fillings, or adjust teeth that are hitting each other excessively hard. And just doing something that really helps you to relax during the day. Right, we're going to have a little break now, and stay tuned for more right after this. I shall be back with some more health tips and hints.
Community Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Something that I was really interested in a short while ago was something called the Great British Intelligence Test. And I don't know, some of you may even have been part of this, but there was a programme on TV recently about this, which was absolutely fascinating, the results of this test. It involved more than 250,000 people in the UK, and it was developed by Dr. Adam Hampshire from the Department of Brain Sciences at Imperial College London. And his team created an online test designed to score individuals on as many different factors that work together to build an intelligence test as he could fit in. You can find this online, Great British Intelligence Test, and it features a series of challenges designed to test every crucial aspect from memory to vocabulary to emotional IQ. And the team also gathered essential information on people's age, lifestyles, interests, where they live as well, to discover if any of these factors are linked to a particular type of cleverness. And the findings are fascinating. And apparently cat owners have better vocabularies than dog owners. Well, I own both. That makes me a genius or something? I don't think so. Anyway, young people did better than their elders on average, but there were some areas where the over 60s scored particularly well. And who would have thought that Londoners come out on top when it comes to emotional intelligence? So you can take the test yourself online. But the most striking piece of evidence was the brain boosting power of computer games. As well as measuring the brain power of the nation, the Imperial College researchers had another important aim. They wanted to examine the impact of screen based activities on our brains. And they were particularly interested in social media use and video games and how they affect the way we absorb information and interact with one another. So they compared the intelligence scores of those who play games several hours a week and those who don't. Gaming might seem like a niche activity, but quite on the contrary, worldwide sales of computer games now top £100 billion a year. And in the UK, polls suggest that 93% of children regularly play games, either on a console or on a computer. But last year, a survey also revealed that up to 42% of 55 to 64 year olds admitted to partaking in a digital game in the past 5 years. So what's happening to our brains? Now, the data revealed that those who spent more time gaming achieved the highest scores for working memory. And that's your ability to hold more than one thing in your mind at the same time. For example, remembering an address while listening to instructions about how to get there. Our working memory is a known predictor of high intelligence and is one of the best indicators of how children perform at school academically. And it's surprising that playing computer games could actually improve any aspect of intelligence. But there is a lot of evidence linking the amount of time people spend gaming with working memory, and particularly spatial working memory, the ability to navigate your way around places such as new cities. And the best games, or the best benefit, comes from high action games such as Call of Duty, which will please many of you out there. Now, these feature quick decision making, navigating around complex environments and finding visual targets. They hone your spatial awareness skills because you're using them both intensely and quickly. Now, you can get similar benefits from playing digital puzzles such as Tetris. That's the one with the colourful falling bricks, in case you don't remember. That's years old, that one, isn't it? And another thing that's quite surprising was that spending hours on social media didn't seem to sap people's IQ either. In fact, it didn't correlate significantly with any indicator of intelligence. However, it did have a significant impact on mental health. And those who admitted to spending the most amount of time intensely browsing through social media and the internet in general reported higher levels of anxiety. Other studies have looked into this, but this was quite a large scale piece of research. Previous smaller studies have shown adolescents who use social media for 5 or more hours a day are 2/3 more likely to display suicidal behaviour than those who use it for an hour or less. There are several possible explanations, but one of the most likely lies in the tendency to present an over-polished version of ourselves online. And this drives users to strive towards an identity that's both unachievable and unrealistic, which causes anxiety and stress. So it would seem spend less time on social media. Instead, video games is probably something that you should be doing. So, wow, that's amazing, isn't it? Finding out that sort of information from this kind of test. But yeah, video games apparently are good for your brain. I'm sure there's many children out there that will be particularly pleased to hear that, but not many parents. Now, if you don't fancy a gaming marathon, there are other more conventional ways of boosting brain power. There's plenty of scientific evidence to show that a healthy body breeds a healthy mind and vice versa. Research suggests that exercise improves scores of mental agility because it increases levels in the blood of something called nitric oxide. And this makes your blood vessels relax and allows more oxygen and glucose fuel to reach your brain. Nitric oxide, I think I could do with some of that now, couldn't I? Get my proper teeth in. Nitric oxide also has a direct effect on the brain, involving brain processing and contributing to learning and memory processes. Even moderate intensity exercise like brisk walking has been seen to double nitric oxide levels. Exercise also boosts levels of a hormone called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and this hormone helps support growth of new brain cells and new connections, particularly in the hippocampus, which is important for memory and learning, all of which are very good reasons to make sure you get your daily outing during the lockdown and walk as briskly as possible. Very, very important. So there's probably a lot of you out there that will be very relieved to hear that information. But what else have we been getting up to in our time at home in this lockdown time? Have you found yourself reaching for a soothing glass of wine or three, or a hefty gin and tonic each night during lockdown? Well, there's nothing wrong with enjoying a tipple. And since the lockdown began, I think people have found themselves drinking a little bit more than usual. And apparently there was something on social media or something like that that says, please open the pubs again before we all turn into alcoholics. It's so much easier to drink at home, isn't it? And you pour yourself a large glass, whereas if you're in a pub, you're getting a specified measure. Our latest figures show alcohol sales have increased by almost 300% during the pandemic, as drinking at home has become the only alternative to socialising over a pint or a bottle of wine in a pub, bar or restaurant. And even those who, under normal circumstances, would never dream of drinking alone, admit to having a comforting glass. And of course, it's understandable if you're working from home, then a drink is an easy way to draw a line under the working day. And those who are stressed about the pandemic, fearful of falling ill or worried about the economic fallout, may find solace and relaxation in alcohol, or it can seem that way. But there are risks, and you need to be careful, because suddenly you might find yourself not being able to stop. And doctors are concerned this period of isolation might lead to an addiction in at-risk individuals, or to relapse in recovered addicts, placing further strain on drug and alcohol services and the health service in general. Indeed, this could develop into yet more collateral damage caused by the pandemic in the months and years to come. And many people have said how they're worried about how their own drinking or that of their partner has increased. So if that strikes a chord with you, just face up to the problem on a personal level. And if it's a partner, family member or friend, then just initiate a conversation. So timing is key as well. Don't discuss it when the person is drinking or drunk. It's tough, but far better to wait until they're sober and you're both calm. And start sentences with I. Too many arguments turn into screaming accusations of you did this and you did that, and that all makes the person feel defensive. And try talking to them, saying, I feel, and say how you feel, when, and describe their behaviour, and because, and then describe the effect of their behaviour on you or other people themselves. And then you're kind of pointing out to them in a nice way the effect that it's having, rather than a direct attack. And assess where they're at. Someone in the full throes of addiction is very different to a person teetering on the brink. And in the latter case, he or she may know they have a problem and be secretly pleased it's been noticed. And someone who is addicted may also be aware of their problem, but fearful of stopping. So be prepared for a negative reaction. And keep it short as well. Have brief but multiple chats, and that gives someone time to mull things over. And by the second or third conversation, you may find they're more amenable to the idea of getting help. But don't expect change overnight. Be absolutely firm about what's unacceptable behaviour, aggression or violence, but be flexible too. And if the drinking continues, it doesn't mean you've failed, but just continue to offer support without dictating what they should do. And focus on the present. Don't dredge up what's happened in the distant past or dwell on things the person has done or said when drunk. Just stick to the problem at hand and what you can both do. And don't forget to listen as well. A person is more likely to confide in you if you don't constantly interrupt or criticise. You can ask questions, but make them open-ended. Just ask why, how and what if. But if you're finding it difficult to talk, you could write a letter. Some people find it difficult to express themselves verbally, so writing allows you to take your time and organise your thoughts. So share your letter and suggest a follow-up conversation when you're both ready. And then encourage them to speak to a professional. If someone is addicted to alcohol, then stopping cold turkey can be dangerous, and a GP can assess and decide if medication is needed to safely wean them off alcohol. And there's plenty of support out there as well. Charities such as AdFam or Al-Anon help families affected by drugs or alcohol. Further resources are available on the NHS website. So I hope you found that useful. It certainly is a very worrying time for all of us. And although hopefully many of us are developing perhaps positive habits, there's many of us that maybe are developing some negative habits too. So not just alcohol, but anything else that you feel perhaps isn't appropriate, or drugs or whatever, anything else that you feel perhaps isn't quite appropriate behaviour in any time, or is affecting somebody negatively. So do try and talk about it, but as I've said, don't go on the attack. Just be aware of the other person's feelings within all of this, and how you can affect a change. Okay, well, I hope you've enjoyed this evening's show. It's been great being with you once again. So until this time next week, take care of your body and take care of yourself.
The demons go away.